The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Yo.
Right. Now we're working. All right. So, congratulations, Boots. It's an incredible film. Everyone here. And I know that every one of you is going to go back to the 30 or 40 or hopefully 50 states and Puerto Rico. If Puerto Rico's in the house, and let people know that they gotta check out this film, which opens actually tonight. Are the first theatrical screenings? Tell us about the rollout of the film.
Well, this weekend is select theaters, select cities, and so the whole thing about that is having a high per screen average so that they can go brag to the other theaters and say, look how much money each screen makes. And then next week is the big thing where it'll start with at least 900 screens next week. So basically everywhere.
Okay, so we gotta pack the houses. We also, everyone, go on Rotten Tomatoes and let people know what a great and important film this is. Also,
if you like it.
How can people follow you, follow the film, tag the film? What's the social media situation?
Well, there's hashtag sorry to bother you. Then there is at Boots Riley on, and that's on everything. And then there is the sorry to bother you Twitter, which is sorry then the number two bother you.
All right. Okay. So share those. Let people know what an important film this is. And while you're at it, also let people know about Boots's book. Which those of you who are going back to the conference, make sure and pick up a copy in the Haymarket Books Room. So Boots, let's talk a minute about this film. One of the things that I think is so remarkable about it is that you can see thousands and thousands of hours of television and movies and never come across the fact that anyone has a job. Or, you know, that anyone has to work to support the gorgeous apartments that they seem to all, you know, live in, even if they might happen to be in Manhattan, and suddenly they've got 3,000 square feet, even though they don't seem to actually have any form of employment. So could you talk about how the centrality of setting this in a workplace and talking about the conditions of workers, how that informed your process?
Well, I mean, I more just start from wanting to talk about things from a real place and connecting them to the larger context of the world and how that works. So that ends up being, you know, your workplace is a big part of where you spend your day. So it's that, and then the context of that, how does that work? Who are you, you know, and within the, you know, within the context of the system, of the economic system. So you end up having a class analysis based on that. And then how do you get those ideas, that analysis in somewhere without, you know, seeming like a preschool teacher, you know. And my approach is just to trust my view of the world and then just make something that feels true to what I think about those situations and how they actually work, and to keep interrogating myself about whether I'm actually putting forward what I think about how that works, and just, you know, more honest with myself about what I think about, you know, the space that they're in and the situation they're going through and what I think motivates those things. And so then if I'm honest with that, then I'm like, well, okay, then that means, you know, I've got to draw this connection, and how do I do that? You know, and so it kind of presents this sort of Rubik's Cube of stuff that starts with wanting to make something that feels real, that comes from, like, you know, seems like it's being experienced at the time.
You worked in a call center. Can you tell us a little bit about what you did, what that experience was, when that experience was, how yeah. that shaped you?
Yeah, I did it in college. I sold newspapers and encyclopedias and stuff. And that was short-lived. But then after our second album, I kind of had a 24-year-old midlife crisis, and I quit doing music. And we started an organization called the Young Comrades. And I needed to be able to support myself. At the time, I didn't have kids, so I could do telemarketing. And I was good at it, so I could just do like a couple of days every week or 2 weeks or something like that.
So you got to the upper echelon.
Yeah, and so there's always, you know, there's always that. There's always the story of the person that bought a house because they were just killing it. You know, they always got all their contacts, and the, you know, story of this person you never met. So,
did you have a white
Jameson.
Voice?
Yes, I did. I mean, I couldn't call it up right now, but
you did find a different voice for your television.
Oh yeah, you figure out what's going to, you know, and at the time you're not like, I'm, you know, subverting the idea of, you know, race right here. You're just like, this is gonna sell, this is gonna work. This person will buy whatever I'm selling a little easier if they don't know I'm black.
So this is your first screenplay, or had you written other screenplays that didn't get to this far?
No, it's my first one. You know, I think, but my first one might be the same as someone else writing 15, because like, just like how I do with songs, I know some people that will write like 20, 30 songs, and they'll like one of them. In that same time that they're writing those 20, 30 songs, I've only written one song. There's nothing wrong with either process. They both, with that same amount of time, come out with one song. But the thing is, I'm editing myself in my head when I'm writing that song and not moving on to the next line till I really feel like that line works and the line before it works with it, and, you know, then going on. So it's a longer process than some do. That's similar to my process with this, is that instead of being like, oh, I got this screenplay and it's this good, let me try again and do better. It's like I, you know, putting my all into each thing as I go ahead.
And as you were doing it, because this is a new genre, you know, were you looking, were there films that were inspirational to you, or screenwriters who were inspirational to you? Were there people who you were looking to learn from their particular craft?
A lot of them, yeah, a lot. That I just kind of absorbed. I mean, Emir Kusturica is a filmmaker that has a lot of chaos and energy all through his stuff. He has a lot of racist depictions of Roma people in the movies that I like, but he has a movie called Black Cat, White Cat that I really like, another one called Time of Gypsies, and another one called Underground. And So I really like what the energy and chaos that he has in the camera movement and in the way the world looks in those things. Paul Schrader's Mishima. Who else? Sergei Parajanov, Color of Pomegranates, like some the way some of the wides are with that. Then maybe some of Michael Cimino's movies, like Deer Hunter and Heaven's Gate, like for the scale and, you know, how the other people in the scenes are used. There's a guy, Lindsay Anderson, who has some movies that I like, a trio of movies called If, and then Oh Lucky Man, and Hotel Britannica. So, I mean, and these are like the ones that I got off on because I found something new that I hadn't talked about before. But, you know, then there's like, you know, the ones that are more well known, like Kubrick. There's Michel Gondry, of course, Charlie Kaufman, Spike Jones. There are a lot of things that I just kind of let them all be in there.
Can you talk a little bit about the transition from the page to the screen? Obviously, you know, it's a huge production. You've got some amazing actors involved. Was there any aspect of the kind of realization of the vision where you realized, oh, to do this scene the way I had written it would cost $5 million, or would need 100 extras, or were there ways that you had to adjust to that transition?
Yeah, like in the McSweeney's version, we put out a version of this as its own screenplay on McSweeney's in 2014. And in the McSweeney's version, when the Equisapiens show up to the battle, there's like 20 of them, and they're coming down the street in a line, and they're flipping cars over and, you know, breaking windows and, you know. Then I was like, well, what if he's just looking at them through a slit? Only sees part of it. So that made it doable. Also, for the calls, I originally had, he's there and the people's world crashes around him. And I theoretically invented this whole rigging system to do that. That was gonna take a day just to do that. So we had to cut that.
Tell us about the locations. Was this all shot in neighborhoods around Oakland? Where else did you work?
Berkeley, so Oakland and Berkeley. Steve Lift's mansion, and the insides were in Berkeley. Steve Lift's mansion was like three places. It was this mansion called Spring Mansion in Berkeley, and then the faculty club at UC Berkeley, and then my son's high school shower room.
All right. Tell us about how you assembled this incredible cast, who I think you rightly earlier called the new Rat Pack of summer of 2018.
We had gone through a number of folks who were pretty well known that wanted to play the lead, and at one point, one of them got like the offer of a lifetime or whatever, but apparently Lakeith's manager was like within earshot, and as soon as I hung up the phone with that dude, Lakeith's manager called, like 5 minutes later, saying, you need to meet with Lakeith. You need to meet with Lakeith. And at this time, I had only seen, I'd seen Short-Term 12, and I saw him in Dope and a couple other things, but I thought that he looked too young, because in the ones where he's clean shaven, he looks pretty young. He's playing like high school students. So, but I agreed to meet with them, looked at some other stuff. By this point, only one episode of Atlanta had come out, so I was like, okay, you know, maybe it'll work. And I met with him, and definitely with the beard, he does not look like a high school student. So, just saw that he definitely was a much older soul than I thought. And he was also really interested in, not, you know, some of the other folks I talked to, they were well known and they seemed to be really interested in getting more famous, you know, in doing something that was, you know, cool or was something under their belt. But he seemed to be genuinely interested in getting better as an actor and really exploring things and open to those things. And and just that he was crazy. There used to be this scene in the script, and we even built the piece for it. There was this that we had to cut for time. But there was a scene in the script that when he gets the job as a power caller, that there's a full frontal nudity scene where there's an interrogation and all this other stuff. And so I was like, look, this is a deal breaker if you want to do this thing. Like, I need a part where we see Cassius at his most vulnerable. And, was going into, you know, why the full frontal nudity was necessary, and he cut me off and he was like, I've been waiting for a role with full frontal nudity. but a few weeks into shooting, you know, we had 63 locations, but we ended up with 61 locations and 28 days to shoot it. And something was gonna have to go. And so that was a scene on the chopping block. But we were a few weeks in and I realized that one of the things that he has is he has the ability to, you know, when you look in his face, he feels innocent and open. He feels vulnerable, like he's open to whatever is happening. And it gives you this vulnerable feeling about him that many great actors can't get. And so I realized that we didn't need that scene for that reason, you know. And because we were cutting that, then that's why Tessa's scene was also now not a full frontal nudity scene. Because I was, you know, like we cut it. They were both gonna have their own separate things, but I didn't want her to be the only one. But yeah, so he, you know, he would, we would talk constantly about the role. And, you know, we did a lot of preparation for it. And although he wasn't the Lakeith Stanfield that he is now, just in that short period of time, other actors knew who he was, and other actors wanted to work with him because they knew how great of an actor he was. So it kind of like casting him sent up a flare of like, this is what kind of movie this is going to be. This is the caliber of acting we want. And so folks like Tessa, who like technically was a much bigger movies or whatever, they were like, I want to do this movie with him. And so, yeah, And she was somebody who I had written a letter to like a year before, and she had not answered. And so I had like moved on, and we were doing chemistry reads with a lot of other people, like just and because I knew that with all the fantastical stuff, not only did I need like real naturalistic performances from the cast, but I needed there to be fire between Cassius and Detroit. And otherwise we're not gonna believe it or care about, you know, we see that in the beginning, it seems like two actors that have to lay in the bed together. It's, you know, it takes you out of it. And so, you know, I had been told that she was offer only, that, you know, she was at such this level. And I was like, well, you know, I know I need to see that, so we're not gonna cast her. Because she's not gonna do a chemistry read, but she was like, sure, I'll do a chemistry read. And then we weren't gonna be able to hook up the time for everybody to be in the same place, so the idea was to do it on Skype, and I was really I was really skeptical about it, because we had just been doing a bunch of chemistry reads, and some of them were awesome, and I had a couple people that I had my eye on for the role, and I was like, okay, I'm not gonna see what I need to see in this, but we did this Skype, three different places, Tessa in New York, Lakeith in LA, and me in Oakland, and there was fire on the screen. And so I was like, okay, there's that one. And you know, so it was kinda, you know, as we built, we got different people from different places. It was kinda like, you know, the part in the heist movie where they built the team. There's even the music playing that kind of sounds like Mission Impossible. And yeah, so, and it, yeah, and you know, as much as I could, I cast against type. One, because I felt like that would be more interesting to me as a director to have an actor that didn't feel like they knew exactly what they were doing, and to be able to take that journey with them. Because if you have somebody, oh, I already do this, no, this is what I do. One, you're not going to see them as that character. So, you know, not only cast against type, but changing the way they look, all those sorts of things that also help the actor.
Could you talk about how Danny got involved and what it was like to have Danny on set, and was he, you know, the role he played with the other actors and with you, having the experience that he's had as an actor, but also the politics that Danny brings to his work?
So, Danny is probably the actor I've known for the longest. Him and my father were both part of the San Francisco State strike in 1968, and that's where they met. The strike that created ethnic studies in the United States. And but he was also the last person to sign on, because your friend's son has a script, so, you know. It took a lot of things developing with it for him to take it seriously. But what he, you know, he brought a gravitas to the process that all the other actors were really looking for and wanting to be around. And there's just a really touching moment, because Danny is very like aloof. Like the gravitas comes from, you know, he's Danny Glover, and he does his thing. And you know, he's very particular about certain things. Somehow, somebody told him he could be a black cowboy in it, so in his mine's a black cowboy, and I was like, oh, that's maybe going too much towards the horse, all that kind of stuff, but it was really a thing. He wanted to be a black cowboy, so he's a black cowboy in that. in his character. And he and he but like at the end of his thing, so he's, you know, just kind of doing his thing, and it's, and he's a fun dude, and he gets up as he's done, he's wrapped, and he gets up to walk away, then he turns towards Lakeith and says, "Hey, I look forward to many years of watching you grow and watching you blow everybody's minds." And so, and walked away. And then I think Lakeith was stunned. So, yeah.
That's a very powerful story. Could you talk about the music in the film, the album, Sorry to Bother You, the forthcoming album, Sorry to Bother You, and how the music informed the making of the film and was part of the process?
So I had made, after I wrote this screenplay, I had made an album to get buzz around the screenplay to hopefully help get it made. It didn't work. But there's an album called Sorry to Bother You. And as we as I started getting further in the process of getting the movie made, I met, well, first I should say there's two worlds of music in this movie. One is the soundtrack, which is a new album by The Coup that's coming out next week or something like that. Woo-hoo. And it's the stuff that the characters can actually hear in that world. In the cafe, I mean, in the bar, in the car, whatever, like in their world, it's able to be heard. That's soundtrack by The Coup. Then there is the score, which is the voice of the movie, which they can't hear. It's, you know, the movie commenting or, you know, giving you a feeling. And that's done by Tune Yards. And so Tune Yards is Merrill Garbus and Nate Brenner. And really cool folks, and you heard some of the music that they did right there. They live in Oakland, and before I was even in the labs, I was working with them on the music. And that's how important the music is to it. Like, before we had cast, before we had investors, you know, anything, we were working on the music. And a lot of, like, what happens when the Equisapien falls out, that was a demo that she had made based on our discussions of influences and stuff like that. That was a really cool process, because they're really talented and both multi-instrumental, and they just kind of sit and, you know, and just make music all day. So the soundtrack, you know, I found that as we were getting the movie prepared, there was a different aesthetic than I had in my mind when I first finished the script and when I made the other album. And so, besides the other album being old, I realized that it wasn't going to work for this movie, that it wasn't gonna help the movie out. And plus it had been a lot of years, so. We made a whole bunch of new music. And a lot of it we made while we were editing the thing. So we'd be like 10 hours editing the movie and then working on the soundtrack the rest of the night and on the weekends.
Well, the product's amazing. It's a huge accomplishment. People, please spread the word. Join me in thanking Booth for coming out first night of the theatrical release, being at the conference, being Boots, and we really look forward to the success and the wide release and viewership of this film. Thank you, Boots. Woo!
I like to say that even if you think everybody knows about this movie, it's not necessarily true. That's just what social media does, is pair you, you know, show you people that already think what you think. And so any posting about it could really help, because maybe your cousins in Milwaukee don't know about it or something like that. And it helps break it out of that bubble. And if you do post about it, please don't give any spoilers away. Just because I hope that people can have that same sort of feeling of discovery. That's kind of what we tried to do, was give the audience a similar emotional feeling that Cassius was going through, and simulate what happens when you find out new ideas that change your view of the world. And so if people are like, oh, I'm waiting for that, somebody said, just pay attention to the jade door, you know, or whatever, you know, it could take them out of it. And if you don't like it, just shh. All right, thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.